This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Let me begin by recommending a couple of books to you that may be helpful in your work. One of the best Jewish scholars writing on Yeshua is Géza Fermes, who's at Oxford, I believe, a Hungarian by origin. His last name is spelled V-E-R-M-E-S. Géza, G-E-Z-A, is his first name. And he's got a number of books on Yeshua. The most recent one, as far as I know, is called The Authentic Gospel of Jesus. And I think he tends to hold a bit more of an apocalyptic view of Yeshua than Dominic Crossan and others would hold. But I think his treatments are superb. So that's one you might want to have a look at, as does Fredrickson. Paula Fredrickson holds such a more apocalyptic view. One of the major scholars on the parables and on the historical Yeshua, a real keystone figure in contemporary Yeshua research, is Burton Mack, M-A-C-K. Burton, B-U-R-T-O-N. His most famous book was, the original one was called A Myth of Innocence. He's talking about Mark's gospel, about Yeshua coming into Galilee and preaching the kingdom of God and preaching a fairly apocalyptic view of the kingdom of God. That's a very good book. It was done in the middle 80s, I think, and is still very powerful. The book that you just held up again for the colleagues is called Who Wrote the New Testament? That's one I don't know, I must confess. Oh. Burton L. Mack.
This is The Making of the Christian Myth.
Making of the Christian Myth. He's always dealing with that that topic of myth. In The Myth of Innocence, he has a splendid chapter on parables, which summarizes the history of scholarship in the last 150 years. It's quite good, and then launches into his own readings of the parables. Another book that he's done before Who Wrote the New Testament is called I've got it here, so I should check its name, The Lost Gospel, The Book of Christian Origins. So it's on the Q text and the Q community. And again, very, very legible, very readable, and superb work. There are many others, of course, that one could refer to. I'm not sure if I've already shown you this volume, which was produced by the Jesus Seminar, or sometimes called Westar Institute. This is called The Five Gospels, and they have another one called The Complete Gospels. So the five are the four canonical gospels plus Thomas. And in here they color code texts, red, pink, gray, and black. So that's a helpful volume. And we'll let that stand as it is. We're still waiting for our PowerPoint cord. A text that appeared in the Los Angeles Times a good few years ago, maybe about 6 or 8 years ago, is called Holy War Brewing Over the Image of Jesus. And two conservative evangelicals named Michael Wilkins and J.P. Moreland, who teach at Biola University in Los Angeles, that's sort of the buckle on the belt of the Bible Belt, if you will, challenge the Jesus Seminar and basically historical research on Jesus in general, saying that if the liberal theologians, liberal or conservative isn't the point, the question is historical critical scholarship. If the liberal theologians' revision of what Jesus actually said and did were correct, he would have been much too likable to be crucified. So they contest all this. There's lots of literature on this. One of the books, I'm going to say it's by Robert Miller, but I'm not sure, is called The Jesus Seminar and Its Critics. That's also a helpful interpretation of the critiques. The Jesus Seminar seems to get singled out for criticism without perhaps those criticized realizing, as I say, that it's only part of the large consensus in which there are enough differences. But this is a group of people who continues to meet, and therefore they get identified as a group And there's lots in the consensus that they don't hold and vice versa. But in any case, the paradigm, that we'll, as we'll see tonight when we get this set up, the paradigm of searching back behind Q for Yeshua is the common trade, the coin and trade of all contemporary exegesis in the New Testament.
Was the author on the Jesus Seminar and its praise?
I think it's Bob Miller, but I'm not sure. It's in our library, I'm virtually certain, so you can find it. Or, you know, one source is if you go to West Star, that's spelled without...
so they have this as well.
They have it on their list of publications. That's where it's been produced. Yes, please.
With all of these books and writers, do we come to what might be called discrete schools, or is this a continuum and they go from every little increment in terms of interpretation?
If we're speaking about, and I know that this is a large totum gatherum term, the mainstream consensus. Now, it's a broad term, and some people would say, well, I'm half in and half out, but if you look at the middle of the road of scholarship in the best universities in England, the continent, and the United States, North America, let me just get this, you'll find that it is exactly as you described it, a broad spectrum, in which there will be differences rather than schools, I guess I would say. Apocalyptic, non-apocalyptic, with all of the shades of that, is one of the topics that's afoot there. Interpretations of post-Yeshua Christian origins, nature of resurrection, what was the first language of resurrection, etc. These will be major areas of dispute. Disputes over how many miracles or wonders, or you call, have any possible historical base. Not necessarily the interpretation the story is told, but something happened down there will also be a matter of dispute. However, that's saying no more than what science does, that within a paradigm there are left, center, and right versions of that. Outside the paradigm, however, and I keep using the term either fundamentalist, I don't think they like that term, but conservative evangelical has a lot of syllables in it. It's like apoplectic eschatology, as Crossan said. But fundamentalists are basically outside of the continuum. On the edge are very good scholars like N.T. Wright, who will still maintain that you can use historical critical scholarship. He's a bishop in the Anglican community in England. You can still use historical critical scholarship and come up with a literal resurrection, come up with attributions of messianic titles to Yeshua, and so on. But that's really getting towards the fringe, I would say.
Are these friendly interactions, or are they polarized and become very intense in their different beliefs?
They call each other Tom and Dom.
Uh-huh.
Tom, N.T. Wright, Thomas Wright calls him, you know, that Dom would call him Tom, and he would call him Dom, and you saw in the Apocalyptic Jesus book they call each other by first names. There's no question that the positions are intense, but I don't think people are slamming doors on each other.
I just wanted to thank you, Dr. Sheehan, for being prophetic and talking to us about eschatology before we went down there.
Well, we read the book.
Yes.
Yeah, that was an important, that is an important topic.
It's hard to get it the first time around.
It is indeed. And Dominic Crossan's distinction between eschatology and apocalyptic eschatology, ethical eschatology, is one that is a distinction that he makes that not everybody follows him on. But at least you know what the possible categories and reads are. Okay, I'll see if I can get this up here, and then let's see if we can make this work. Are there other questions? Yes, please.
In the parables on the Samaritan, there's a discussion between Luke and Mark. And is there any significance in the fact that under Mark it was Jesus that replied?
Not the Samaritan, but... Is it the Samaritan?
Yeah.
Why don't you direct me to the page here so you'll jog my memory.
It's the discussion on the greatest commandment.
Okay, and what page are we on? Are we in Brandon Scott's book?
Yeah, but I found it in the New Testament when I was referenced back to...
Go ahead, please.
The New Testament, and in Mark's Gospel, it's Jesus that replies to the answer of what the greatest commandment is. And in Luke, it's the scholar who replies. Is there any significance in that?
You know, I don't have that prepared right now, so I don't know what answer to give you at this moment. That's not the Samaritan parable, though, right? That's the that's a dialogue between Yeshua. It comes up in that passage, right? I'll show you what I'll do instead is show you another paragraph, another passage that we're going to talk about this evening, in which that same differentiation comes up, and we'll find out that what's really going on is a redactional decision by one of the evangelists. And I can't tell you right now about that particular passage. I'll have to do some work and look it up. This computer is taking a long time. It's very slow, so if you'll be patient with me. Are there other things you'd care to say or discuss?
Could you just repeat the entire title of the book that starts, Holy War Brewing Over the...
Holy War. Oh, I beg your pardon. That was just an article in the Los Angeles Times. Do you want to get it? I mean, it's called Holy War Brewing Over Image of Jesus, but it's just two or three columns in an old Los Angeles Times. Yes, please.
I don't know if you're going to hit this some other time in the course, but I've just run across many passages in the New Testament where a lot of what Jesus says is somewhat out of character for what I understand the Middle East to have been at the time.
For example, could you give an example of the out of character?
Well, things like judge not lest you be judged. And let's see. Very simple. Whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn him to the other also. Things that are...
That's definitely Q community, isn't it? I noticed,
well,
by the way,
know.
You're using the Jefferson Bible.
That's right.
That has the good wisdom sayings in it.
That's right. So, but I guess my question is, in a lot of ways, these actually are consistent with some Buddhist thought. And since Buddhism, or since... personally considered to be Buddha, lived about 600 years before this. I was just wondering if there was any possibility in the period between 12 and 30 years of age where he might have either come in contact with a traveler from that discipline, or whether he might have traveled in that direction, or do we have any information about any of that?
We don't, of course. Concerning the pre-baptismal life of Yeshua, we have no information,
right,
except that he was born. And even after, between baptism and execution, we don't have a lot of information about his contacts and so on. We're really trying to piece that together, as we'll say this evening. Or could it have been, rather than contact with someone who taught him such wisdom, could it have been part of the radicalness of his own preaching when he uses what Scott calls minor wisdom traditions in Judaism, mm-hmm, of don't resist, etc.?
Well,
could there be something in common, perhaps?
Yeah, it had occurred to me that there are common philosophy, common elements of philosophy across some of the major religions, and that may have been
In fact, the colleague last time mentioned the book by Karen Armstrong called The Great Transformation, mm-hmm, which deals with the so-called, this is Carl Jasper's name, the axial age in which things shift. And you can draw this quite broadly, but sometime between the 600s, Buddha, down to maybe even the Greek sages. She doesn't think much of that, but also the wisdom tradition in Judaism from 300 on. What you get is a common denominator, she argues, of such elements as compassion, non-resistance to violence,
right,
and so on. So I don't know enough about comparative religion to wonder whether that was around.
Of the Old Testament, and what little I know of Jewish philosophy at that time was pretty confrontationalist. I mean,
In Judaism, there were the confrontationalists. There were definitely the guerrillas and the Maccabees, the Sicarii, the Zealots. I'm not sure that we can judge. We don't know a lot, frankly, about Judaism in the first century. We know much of it by way of contrast with the Yeshua movement. and then the destruction of the temple and rabbinic Judaism starting up. But we don't know a lot about their prayer life. We don't know an awful lot about what synagogue discussions were like. We just don't have the evidence. I always fear that the traditional anti-Jewish bias of Christianity tends to read the God of Tanakh as a God of vengeful justice and the God of Christianity, the father of Yeshua, as a God of love. I just don't think that that works. I think that the God of Tanakh, it depends on what stream you're reading, can be the most compassionate God who can speak of his people as a wife, as someone whom he loves desperately, who, you know, and they have marital problems is almost the way the prophet Hosea sees it. But in any case, perhaps, is there more before we get going? Yes.
I just wanted to say that sometimes easier rather than looking for Buddhist influences to think about the whole Hellenistic matrix that and especially where reality was. I mean, there was a lot of things, I mean, and King Ashoka sent Buddhist monks were on Cyprus at some point. I don't know how long they stayed there, but the whole Hellenistic...
Who was there?
Buddhist monks were
on Buddhist monks in Cyprus.
That was around 360
The tradition of, I mean, because that was not only an economic and a political crossroads, it was also a cultural crossroads, inevitably so. Therefore, for example, to give another example, and then I'll simply refer to this and stop because I can't say too much more about it. Alexandria, the main city of Egypt, Cairo didn't exist at the time. Alexandria is where all sorts of Indian wisdom was present because of the trade, it, which may indeed be the source of Neoplatonic philosophy. Ammonius Saccas was a stevedore on the Alexandrian docks around the year 200, 215. Never wrote anything, but was a popular philosopher influenced by the Indian Upanishads. A philosopher named Brehier, B-R-E-H-I-E-R, has a book on Plotinus in which he talks about how that tradition feeds in. Plato may well have been influenced by Orphic traditions coming out of Asia Minor. So it's hard to draw the lines as to where things that were coming from even Central Asia, Southern Central Asia, Zoroastrianism, then moves through Persia, then moves into what is now Iraq, and then influences even Jewish intellectuals. So it's a marketplace of ideas and cross-influences.
The question is, who had motive to kill Jesus?
The question is what?
The question of who had motive to kill Jesus under what law? Money changing is a serious business today and as well as then. Communist Russia in the Cold War days had a 10-to-1 difference between official exchange rate and the free market rate. And many third world countries even today have like a 10-to-1 difference between official and informal free market exchange rates. And if there was something like that at Jerusalem, I mean, you know, 10-to-1 ratio, and you know, then it really is a den of thieves. And but it would have been both the Romans and the high priest, you know, collecting a big part of this. And it probably was a capital offense to overturn the money changers.
Okay, we'll get to that. We'll hope to get to that when we read Crossan on who killed Jesus. We haven't even gotten him alive
yet. That alone was a capital offense to the Russian society. The Romans.
Okay.
It's like
okay.
Anything else that Jesus did.
Tonight in our 2 hours of meeting, I'd like to divide things in half. And in the first half, review a bit of where we've been and get into the parables. Into issues in the parables. In the second half of our meeting, I'd like to go through some of the parables that Brandon Scott raises. We can't do them all, obviously, but let's deal at least with the leaven and the mustard seed, the first two that he deals with, which you certainly will have read. There's lots of side material that I want to treat. The slide that that you're looking at now talks about the goal, the means, and the method. And then the method will continue on the next slide. This is by way of review of what we've seen so far and a way of focusing on what we're after. Let's be clear that we are not out to write a life of Yeshua. That was a popular form of literature in the 1940s and 50s in the United States. A famous popular author named Jim Bishop wrote a number of books. The Day Christ Died, he treated it the way a journalist would treat it, and treated his life the way a biographer would. We cannot write a biography of Yeshua. We don't have a chronology. We only know the two historic dates that we know of have to do with his baptism and his execution. We can date the execution fairly closely, and we can argue back to the date of the baptism. We have no chronological scheme that seems to be credible historically. Mark's chronological scheme is the one that's adopted by Matthew and Luke, and it is a fiction. So we don't have the chronological basis for writing a life of Yeshua. We don't even have a strong enough grip on the words of Yeshua. We divide his life, or what we could say about his life, into his words and his deeds. For example, his alleged miracles, or his overturning of the tables in the temple, etc. Those would be in the realm of deeds, right? From which we deduce, and it's a tricky thing, what he may have thought about himself, his self-conception, his self-understanding. So that would be number three. Right? We just don't have enough in that regard to write a life. We can, however, especially by looking at the words of Yeshua, his logia, we say in Greek, the things that he said, we can begin to get a profile, or better plural, a number of profiles. Marcus Borg has a different take on him than, for example, Dom Crossan does on certain issues. So we're after a profile of Yeshua, not a biography or a life of Yeshua. We just can't write it. Right. Secondly, in order to do the profile, still we're staying up there with goal, we can do what was referred to, as Dom Crossan points out, we can delineate the matrices in which he lived and from which he drew and which he influenced and which influenced him. Those matrices are plural. At the broadest outer circle is, of course, the Roman Empire, which dominated that area. Closer in is Jewish culture, religious and social culture. Closer in yet is Galilean culture. As we've seen, it's quite different from Judean culture. Galilee is a quite different place. In fact, Burton Mack, in the book on Q, has a nice chapter on Galilee, its Hellenization, and so on and so forth. The next matrix in is his social class. He's, the word that Dominic Crossan uses, is peasant, by which he means someone without land. But that doesn't mean that he tilled the land for someone else. By peasant, he means landless. And it is quite possible, as I think Scott suggests, or others, that his family may have lost their land once upon a time, and he may have had to take up the trade of what is called just generically tecton, which means laborer, you know, with some skill. He could have been a stonemason, he could have been a hod carrier, he could have been a carpenter, the traditional designation of him. But that's his peasant class. So those would be the matrices that influence Yeshua. And then, as far as the person goes, we have to find out what he said, what he did, from that deduce what he thought about himself, and then see what movement took up after him, because that will tell us something, the closer we can get to Yeshua, what sort of a person he may have been, what kind of an impact he would have made. Secondly, the means, or better perhaps the approach that we're taking in the most general terms, is to distinguish Yeshua from the matrices, and especially from the movement that followed in his name, but not just that, but also the Judaism of the time and the Judaism of the time of the Christian communities. I don't have room here to put up a formula on the board, so I'll just say it out loud and you can write it down if you will. If you wrote down the formula for making sense out of something, it would be as follows. Capital S equals capital P. That's the diagram of a sentence. You have a subject of the sentence, the election's next Tuesday, and then you have any number of possible predicates, meanings that you can attach to that subject, the election's next Tuesday. And in between the two of them is a linking up represented by an equal sign, S equals P. That equal sign looks very impersonal, but underneath that equal sign is a community of people. It might be just you, but probably others share your opinion, that the meaning of the elections next Tuesday is P1, Whereas others over there will say, no, the meaning of it is P2. So we'll have a democratic community, a republican, a libertarian set of community. We have different ways of making sense out of things. Please excuse the banal example I'm using. Now, if underneath that you put the formula for making sense out of Yeshua, it would take, in its traditional forms, Y equals M, or J equals C. Y equals M is the Aramaic, right? Yeshua is the Mashiach. The J equals C would be the Greek translation of that. Jesus is the Christos. Jesus is the Christ. And underneath that equal signs, you have various communities. In fact, it's not just predicate 1, predicate 2, predicate, there's plural predicates. So likewise, we're using C as only the generic term for a religious evaluation of Yeshua, positive religious evaluation. There are other secular evaluations. Huh? Y equals T. Yeshua equals trouble. Footnote Caiaphas. Right? We have to do something about this man. He could bring the Romans down on our neck. That's a secular interpretation. I think Caiaphas was probably historically very, very accurate, perhaps more accurate historically than the Gospels are. Right? So that's the formula for making sense out of anything, and specifically about Yeshua. Now, we're trying to distinguish the Y from the M, or the J from the C. And the predicate side is broadly construed. There are two elements of predication about Yeshua that we're trying to keep him distinct from. One is, we'll call it, in quotes, the church of the first century. It means those members of the Yeshua movement. You can call it Christianity if you want. It takes a while to be so nominated Christian, right? We're trying to separate it from the church, and we're trying to separate it from not only temple Judaism before 70 CE, but rabbinic Judaism after 70 CE. When the temple is destroyed, when the Pharisees are basically thrown out of a job, they were the priestly caste, and there's no more temple for them to operate in. Did I say Sadducees? That's what I meant to say. The populous Pharisees, the people who are out there in the villages trying to make Torah understandable for people in their day-to-day lives, become the ones who are the carriers of the Jewish tradition. After 70, sometime between 70 and 90, groups of them gather on the coast of Palestine at a city called Jamnia or Jabne, depending on how you spell it and pronounce it. And that is the locus of the foundation of what we call rabbinic Judaism, which continues right up to our own day. From temple to synagogue, there were already synagogues, but now that's going to be the focus of Jewish life and the home, of course, as always. So we want to separate Yeshua from pre-70 and post-70 Judaism, because there's mostly a confliction, two different types of conflict between Yeshua and the Judaism of his day. But the first group is what we'll call the church, or the early Yeshua movement. And there, as you know, we've got a set of distinctions. Let's make at least three. Number one, you've got the Galilean rural community, probably bilingual, but mostly Aramaic. In the same way that, for example, in my Italian side of my family, at home, we always speak Piemontese dialect. Out publicly, we speak Italian, good Italian. They're close, but not exactly the same. And any of you who have other languages in your families know that there's a kind of an at-home language and a public language. They could be close, like dialect and Italian, and they could be quite distinct, like Aramaic and Greek. So there's one group. It's a rural-based group, or a village-based group. And we have scribes who will eventually be the authors of Q. They'll write it in Greek because it's there for publication to other villages where dialects can be different, etc. And it may also be taken to cities. So that's our first group that we associate with the Q community. The second group is urban, and it's Jerusalem-based. We talked about the difference between the life of Yeshua as focus of the north, the death of Yeshua, and the resurrection story as focus of the south. Well, in that urban group, Greek is definitely the predominant language, right? Even though they're sharing all sorts of traditions. A third group is the diaspora outside of Palestine, mostly urban, right? The Jews that Paul evangelizes in southern Turkey, southern Asia Minor, in Greece, and ultimately we think in Rome, we're not sure if he got there, are urban dwellers, Greek speakers. And as Crossan pointed out, Peter had to speak Greek, and that's the only way he could communicate in Antioch when he joins the community there, and Rome and other places. So you've got Syria, Asia Minor, Greece, Rome, and also Egypt, Alexandria, and the what will finally become the Coptic Church. As you know, the word Egypt, which in Greek is pronounced with a hard G, Egyptos, becomes the basis of Coptic. Egypt and Coptic are cognate, so that becomes the Church of Egypt. Okay, now apart from, we're trying to distinguish these not because anyone has anything, at least from this side of the podium, against Christianity and its Christian interpretations. That's not the issue. We're about a historical task of seeing what we can sort out critically, that is to say scientifically, just about the historical Yeshua, leaving it to whoever wants to make the connection of an existential evaluation, that this has some historic meaning for you or not. That's not the purpose of our class. We're just simply trying to find out how this thing works. The method for getting the authentic words of Yeshua, which is our focus this week, this evening, right? Not the deeds of Yeshua, which we'll get to, but the words of Yeshua, is burrowing from within. The only access we have is through, major access we have, is through Christian texts, which are themselves already shot through with theological evaluations of Yeshua. They are inner, inside documents, if you will. The method is to use those texts not so much against themselves, but rather to run the movie backwards. The texts represent a forward-moving evaluation of Yeshua in which each major step is an absorption and reevaluation of the earlier step. And in general, we see increasing Christology. Greater powers are assigned to Yeshua the further we move into the first century. Our task is to read those texts, but to replicate them in reverse, to run backwards the evaluation until we at least get to Q, and then ask if we can make the leap from Q back to Yeshua. So it's a reverse replication. Yes, please, a question.
Why run backwards instead of forwards? I wondered that when I read the book.
The reason why is that the texts themselves are at the end of the process. The texts we have are post-70. So they've already reached Messiahhood in the three synoptic gospels, and divinity in the fourth gospel of John. So we're already at the end of the process. So if we ran them forward, the only way to treat them, if we're going to deal with the texts, is to try to do a history of how they got there. So in one sense, if maybe I
understand.
Yeah, we're going to replicate. I shouldn't use the word reverse. No, we're going to replicate the history.
Where you find something at the end, you want to go back to find its root.
You said it better than I could have. Yeah, we're looking for the historical origin as far back as we will get textually as Q and Thomas. Then there's still the gap between Q Thomas and Yeshua. So that's where we're going to have to employ our various criteria.
As long as I'm on the subject,
please.
I've been disturbed ever since I read your book about oracle, Pericles. Can I talk about that now?
About what again?
Pericles.
Pericope. Pericope, we call them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll have them up here in a second. In fact, we already do have them up here.
You define them as oral statements, and you define them as the building blocks of the conclusions which are reached as to the words of Yeshua. Now, I've spent 65 years going through evidence and deciding which is true and what's not true. And of all the sources that you have in a situation like that, the least credible is somebody's statement of what somebody else said a long time ago. It seems to me that pericope, is that pericope?
Pericope.
Are really raising themselves by their own bootstraps.
Okay, you're raising good questions about that. I wonder if...
Am I ahead of you? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, your question is well pointed. But I don't want to cut you off. Why don't you ask your full question? We'll see if we can.
That at the bottom of all of this, it seems to me that it comes down to a question of taking all of the evidence that you have and coming to a fairly subjective conclusion about where the truth lies. And it is, you'll have to take it as a given, it is absolutely impossible to know with any degree of certainty, any even degree of reasonable certainty.
We call it probability instead of certainty. Yeah.
What was actually said.
You know,
isn't this a useless exercise?
Is it useless? We have the same thing going on in this building. This is called the History Building because the History Department is located here. And they're dealing sometimes with periods way before Yeshua, in which you're talking about bits of dirt and sand, and clay bricks, and so on. And they're always interpreting. Someone might want to say that as soon as you interpret, you're getting into subjectivity. There is no human knowledge that isn't interpretative, including hardcore natural science, because it sets a paradigm. That's the framework of interpretation, right? And it tests data in terms of that paradigm. If there's a fit represented by predictions, etc., we work with that. Interpretation is what we're condemned to. We can talk about different arenas of interpretation, natural science, you and your spouse, you and poetry. And what we call objectivity, which I think is a very problematic word, really means that which corresponds to a communal subjectivity. We in this community of scientists hold that the Earth is spherical. These people over here hold that it's flat. And you really are not going to talk them out of it. We think we're absolutely right. But every objectivity is correlated with a group, a subjective group, a group of people who, however, correct themselves, presumably. Wait a minute, you haven't thought of this, says one. Well, I did. Try this out. But there is no Archimedean point of view, be it in history or in the arts or even in the natural sciences, where someone stands outside of an hypothesis and says, that's absolutely what it is.
You don't agree then that there is a particular wavelength, measurement of wavelength of life in a certain color? Isn't that an objective?
Of course I do. I do because I'm a member of the community who holds it. But what do you do with the fact that in 2 months we may find out that the COBE background radiation map that just won the guys 2 Nobel Prizes, which goes back to allegedly 400,000 years after the Big Bang, might not be 6,000 years. And we may push it up or we may push it back. Data determines, but the hypothesis, no data answers a question by itself. It doesn't speak for itself. It speaks only in response to a question put to it by a group of scientists.
I don't mean to take too much time, but let me just add one more
please
paragraph of comment.
Right.
We have all kinds of tangible sources about the time of Yeshua. There are thousands of artifacts, thousands of documents.
All subject to interpretation.
All subject to our interpretation. The one thing that we don't have is one single written word that we can trace to him. Not only that, we don't have anybody who says that they know what he said until 50 years after he's been crucified. And to me,
that's pretty bleak.
That's
can you think of anyone else in antiquity from whom we have not one written word, but only allegations, which none of us trusts are verbatim, of what he said? Is there another famous figure?
Socrates.
Socrates never wrote a word. We actually, that may not be true because they think they found a tombstone. He was a chiseler, you know, a tombstone cutter, and they may have actually found a tombstone that could be traced to him. So the search for the historical Socrates. Now we have found his prison where they executed him. We're almost certain we've got the very room. It's now excavated in the west side of the Agora in Greece. Right? But there's another example. We also don't have any word that Augustus wrote. Mm-hmm. We've got something that his scribes wrote for him. It's the Res Gestae Augusti Imperatoris. But we don't have any words of his either.
But we have contemporary writings of those people.
Let's see. Suetonius is about 40 years after the death of him, or maybe more. No, Suetonius is more. He's like 60. If he dies in 14 CE, Suetonius is writing in the 90s? Am I right on that? 70s even. So it's about the same distance between Suetonius, the closest historian to Augustus. What we're facing, I'm not trying to say that anything other than that these... It doesn't make our case any better.
There's some bad case, but doesn't mean this isn't the bad
right. case. But what I would urge us to distinguish is that each area of subject matter that we deal with, our spouse, our children, natural science, movies, Yeshua, each subject matter has its own method. If we apply the method of science to our wives, forget it, that's it. If we apply the method of emotional and interpersonal relationship to our spouse to the laboratory, forget it. What I want to distinguish is the different arenas, the different regions of research, of possible research, that dictate different methodologies. Perhaps what we've done since the Enlightenment, and especially since the positivistic 19th century, is one method fits all. And I don't think that works, certainly doesn't work in this building. I'm not a member of the history faculty, but they use historical method, not natural scientific method.
I offer the class my excuse.
No, you raised a very good question.
Real quick, last weekend on KQED, they had a thing about the Louvre lending some paintings to a new art museum in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
Among the paintings shown was a painting, I guess it's medieval anyway, I'm not sure, maybe Renaissance, but a painting showing an angel whispering to St. Mark as he wrote his gospel.
There's another one, an angel whispering in Matthew's ear in San Luigi Francese in Rome.
And if you believe in angels, then all this, you know, looks, you know, I mean, it appears in an entirely different light.
Right. So we have to look at that framework.
So we kind of have to start beginning, you know, do we think that this is Yeshua is just another man, or is he someone around whom angels are getting involved?
Yeah. I want to believe in angels. I think that since it's now, my goodness, it's 10 minutes to 8, so perhaps we should just continue a little bit here.
Please. Could I just ask one question based on what he said? I think in most of the Christian religious groups that the assumption is that from a religious standpoint, the Bible is the inspired word of God, which is probably why they start to protest when you
want it. Basic presupposition, inspired, inerrant, and literally true. We can start adding on to those things. That's definitely a basis. Okay, I'll just run through roughly this slide and the next one, and then we'll see if we can then take a break and come back. There are three levels of criticism, and they pretty much correspond to a chronological development. The 19th century is the origins of source criticism. The early 20th century is the period of form criticism. It's actually in German called the history of forms, Formgeschichte, but we use the word criticism, historical criticism of the forms of texts. And the third is post-World War II. It's sometimes called, fairly broadly, the new quest for the historical Jesus or Yeshua. I'll just call it Yeshua research. It's a new quest to find out if anything that we have as a result of the former two forms of criticism can be traced back to the Jewish peasant wisdom preacher of Galilee. Source criticism is the effort to find out which, the interrelationship of all the sources that we have and which one is the earliest. And this is where we begin to sort out what comes first, what comes second, and it's where we look then for multiple attestation of independent sources within that. Form criticism looks at the New Testament, to go back to the colleague's question, looks at the New Testament and notices that it is something like, the metaphor is Debelius's, it looks like a string with beads on it. Because you find one evangelist taking those beads and gathering the red ones together and making a discourse out of them. Someone else gathering those together and making another discourse. They could be interchanged one with the other. So they really are, they seem to be independent units. And the word for the word perikopi comes from the Greek word to cut out, as if you could just cut out these little phrases and arrange them any way you want, the way you sometimes get those little words of poetry and put them on your refrigerator and you can move them around and make different funny verses, right? So a pericope is a cutout, it's a unit. Having identified a pericope, and I'll refer you to that book by Fermesh, The Authentic Gospel of Jesus, in which he does a fine job, lays it out very, very clearly, of all the different types of units. Some are going to be threaty, excuse my voice here, some are going to be threat statements. Look out because hellfire is coming your way, in effect, to the cities, right? Some of them are going to be legal advice or religious advice. Some of them are going to be warnings, etc. So we set them up in their types. Then ask, what was the community situation that led them to gather these together or to redact them in a certain way, to put this beginning and this middle and this end on them, because we can also often find the insertions in them, right? So that's called the position in the community's life, the Sitz im Leben, the position in life that led this community, presumably Galilean or later on diaspora, to redact, to edit those units in such and such an order or form. That's how we find out what the concerns of that community were, whether they're mostly Gentile, whether they're mostly Jewish, whether they're Greek-speaking Jewish or Aramaic-speaking Jewish. We can work on that in order to get to the community here. Notice what we're doing here is that history of transition, transmission, that re-replicating how these Gospels grew and then sort of reversing it to find out where it came from. Yeshua research, or the new quest for the historical Jesus, is based on, first of all, getting the transmission correct as best as we can, again, with whatever probability we can muster, and then using the criteria, after we've gotten the tradition correct, back to, let us say, Q or back to Thomas, we still have that gap of what, 10, 20 years, 20 years perhaps between the death of Yeshua and the writing, the actual writing of Q. We've got that period of oral transmission, which may well go back into the life of Yeshua himself. That's where we try to make the leap by the criteria. The history of transmission, I keep saying that, is trying to get from the Gospels at the end of the trajectory of transmission, from, let us call it, the church's use and revision of these traditional pericopes. And, as Scott points out, as Dominic pointed out, the possible domestication of Yeshua's voice, which we can find in some of the parables, for example, and then get back to, if possible, the voice of Yeshua himself or the earliest followers of Yeshua, which, empirically we find, has a much more radical, freewheeling, and non-institutional approach. By the time the Gospels are written, we are in institution time. Communities are forming, house communities, house churches, etc. So therefore they've got a history to talk about and defend. They've had troubles. They want to talk about they want to interpret a parable in terms of the troubles they're having with the synagogue, for example, or the troubles they're having with pagans, for example, you know, non-Jews, non-Christians. So we can see them adapting. What we're trying to do is peel back to that authentic voice. And the way to do that, just by way of review, are the various criteria, the basic ones of multiple attestation and dissimilarity. We want to get Yeshua free from the church interpretations of Yeshua. Not that there's anything wrong with them, right? But simply to find out what the difference is. So dissimilarity, embarrassment, which will be one of the reasons why we'll be able sometimes to attribute things to the early church, plus coherence and rejection, we talked about that already. I've doctored up just a bit the diagram that you've seen before to make clear again what's going on. The way we postulate Q is that we see that in Matthew and Luke, 90% of Mark is repeated in Matthew. 50% of Mark is replicated in Luke. There will be some verbal changes, but more often than not, it is close to verbal replication. There is indeed special material that only Matthew has, only he speaks about the flight into Egypt, the Magi, for example, etc., and special information that only Luke has, or special stories that only Luke has, the Samaritan being one of those. So we'll call that special Luke, special Matthew. But then we've got that overlapping area between Matthew and Luke that points back to a hypothetical, but nonetheless a strong hypothesis it is, of a written text, no doubt founded on oral traditions, a written text that they could quote writtenly in the Greek. We find out, thanks to the discovery, first of all, as you know, in 1900, fragments of the Gospel of Thomas were found. Only in 1945, in central Egypt, in Nag Hammadi, was the full Gospel found in the Coptic language, the Egyptian language, close to Greek, but distinct, written in quasi-Greek characters that we call Coptic. And there, for the first time, we found another, no, we can't say we found another, we found the first sayings Gospel ever, which lends credence to the fact that Q was a sayings gospel. It had only been hypothetical before, still is hypothetical now, but now we have another instance of one like that. We, especially through the work of Kloppenborg and Steve Patterson, etc., which we can't go into the methodologies for, distinguishing out the basic level of Q, the earliest level of Q, which is all wisdom tradition, parables, aphorisms, proverbs, sayings, right? Not apocalyptic. That comes later. And the hypothesis is that it represents conflict between the original community and it, the problems it's having spreading or convincing other people. Only last do we get the narrative framework, basically the narrative framework of baptism and execution, of Yeshua, temptation in the desert, etc. So there's a corollary between early Q wisdom and Thomas as a wisdom document, which will eventually end up as a Gnostic document. What I'd like to do, now we can't do it now because we have only 3 minutes, but what we'll do when we come back is not just look at diagrams, not just make assertions, but try to go through three texts that will give us some sense of how we peel back, that's my inadequate metaphor, to try to get to the earliest Q statement before we even try to attribute to Yeshua. Please.
What's a simple definition of Gnostic or Gnosis?
A simple definition would be a very variegated movement of the second and third century and following that drew upon Jewish mysticism, Greek philosophy, Oriental wisdom, its postulate being that far from looking to historical events as the locus of salvation, we get higher knowledge from higher entities. Well, now I can't go into the whole mythology, that is given to us in a kind of a non-material way. So gnosis means knowledge, right? And that becomes the focus of a certain type of Christian religion. You can already see the intimations of Gnosticism in John's Gospel. Right? You already have this idea that he's teaching wisdom from beyond. I've come to bring you God's word. In fact, I am the divine Savior entered into your world. And that was another story as part of the multitude of Gnostic myths. So it's basically elite knowledge communicated to an elite group that will finally lead you out of the body and into the realm of the spirit. So let's take a break now of some 10 minutes or so. Come back and see if we can hold ourselves to the task of studying the parables. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's get going here. We're just a tad behind, so let's take an example of source criticism. How do you take the plurality of texts running around the same issue and try to find out what seems to be the earliest one? We'll take three. We'll take Mark, Luke, and Matthew on the same topic. So here's the first. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking a sign from heaven to test him. How do we know that we should believe you? Make something happen. Thunderbolt, lightning, stop the rain, whatever. He sighed deeply in his spirit and said, now this is what the Greek says, if a sign is given to this generation, comma, truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. Doesn't make sense grammatically, in English or in Greek, because it is a Hebraic oath. God strike me dead, I'll eat my hat. before you'll get any sign from heaven. No, no sign will be given to this generation. That bracketed phrase, I'll eat my hat, or God strike me dumb and dead, right, was not allowed, was a legitimate oath in the Judaism of the time, but in the early Q community, they didn't allow oaths. The word is enough. Let's just say yes and no. You don't have to raise your hand and say, so help me God. So the fact that we've got a Hebraicism embedded in Mark's gospel is an interesting fact. Let's go further. 15 years later, more or less, we've got Luke saying telling the same story, but with some additions. When the crowds were increasing, he began to say, so that goes back to the colleague who asked, you know, what do I do about the difference between the interrogator says what the law is, and Yeshua says, you got it, come, you know, give everything away and come follow me, and he won't do it. So here we have a change. The crowds are increasing, and he began to say, now he takes the active attack side, not just talking about this generation wants a sign, but it's evil. Got a little bit of anger going on here. It's an evil generation, open parentheses, because it seeks a sign. It doesn't just accept the word that I've been preaching. Now you want some proof? That's what makes you evil. Well, I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation. Period. Mark. Luke continues, except, he adds him, let's give it to them, the sign of Jonah. Like Jonas, Jonah. Right. In the Tanakh, he goes off to the Assyrian capital. These are the bad guys. And preaches to them at Nineveh, and they repent. So now Luke adds, as Jonah became a sign to the people of Nineveh, so will the Son of Man be a sign to this generation. Notice the parallel. At judgment, the people of Nineveh will rise up from the dead, will rise with this generation, but they will condemn this generation. Why? Because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. But look, something greater than Jonah is here. Now that's a considerable rewrite of what seems to have been an earlier version. But again, notice what the new edition is. Jonah preached, they repented. I preach, you don't repent. You don't believe. You demand a sign. So I'll tell you what the sign is. They repented, and they're going to condemn you at the last judgment or at when. Notice we got a judgment in there, which is already Luke's story. Now, let's go to Matthew. Matthew's Jewish Christian community has fire in its belly about the Jewish community because they were somehow expelled or they fought with them and left, something like that. And indeed, the Jewish communities after the 80s were cursing Christians as part of their synagogue worship. The Christians have more than repaid, trust us, over the last 2,000 years. In any case, now we get the scribes added to the Pharisees. We're back to Mark's thing about the Pharisees saying to him, but now we got the professors, the scribes, saying to him, not in your face, but teacher, rabbi, we wish to see a sign from you. It's much nicer. But he answered them and said, not only evil, but adulterous generation seeks a sign. But no sign will be given to it, period, Mark. Except the sign of Jonah, Matthew. But look what he adds. The last four lines are as more or less as in Luke. For we've got two stories about Jonah. He preaches at Nineveh and they repent. He gets swallowed by a whale and is belched up 3 days later. Now that second story is put in. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Resurrection prediction. Clearly, long after the death of Yeshua. Then he goes back to the Matthean edition to Mark. The people of Nineveh will arise at the judgment with this generation, and they will condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah, but look, something greater than Jonah is here, and you still don't repent. So we've got a double whammy here. It's not only increased in your face, evil and adulterous. Not only is it preaching, that sounds like possibly going back to Yeshua. I mean, he was a preacher. But now all of a sudden we've got the resurrected Yeshua thrown in there, predicting, by the way, his resurrection. So that's a kind of a, I hesitate to use the word slam dunk these days, but that's a fairly obvious example, and I pick it because it's simple, where you can begin to see the additions given the situations of each of the evangelists, where they edit in, they redact in, other material that seems to be building on Mark. And therefore we'll say, Mark looks like, there's a good case that could be made, that it is the earliest in the history of transmission of this pericope, but it may not go back to Yeshua. Let's see, I think I may have, I think this is a more or less, no, it's not our last slide, but almost. Now we start to get into the parables, okay, so this is now our official second hour. We are dealing with the words of Yeshua, we'll talk about his deeds another time. And as regards those words, let's distinguish three types of religious speech. These are not the only three types available in first century Judaism. For example, there's ritual priestly speech and sermonizing, etc., etc. So we're not talking about that. We're not talking about scribal legal language. But we're talking about three that we've discussed before and have a sense of. I'll treat them in not the order they're up there. First, prophetic speech, then apocalyptic speech, and then wisdom speech. Remember that prophecy has two different meanings, and the earlier meaning is the correct one, if you will, or at least the more original. The later meaning comes from the apocalyptic literature, and it refers to prophecy as speaking about that which lies ahead. The pro of prophecy, phasis is speak, the pro means ahead of time, predicting what's going to come in the future. And that we showed, tried to show, was one element of the stage props of apocalyptic literature. After an event is over, you postulate a figure who preceded the event, predicting that these events are going to happen, so that he can also predict to me that tomorrow the temple will be cleansed. However, the first meaning of prophecy is public, clear speech before the people in the name of God. So the pro there has two meanings. In front of the people and in the service of God, clearly about not mystagogic things, but economic, social, political, military issues. That's what prophets talk about. Why do you cheat each other? Right? I don't want religious practice, I want justice, says Micah. That's social prophecy. Right? Or if the prophets at the time of the Assyrian attack and the Babylonian attack say, don't trust your armies, trust God. Right? That's about politics. It's telling them how to run their politics in the presence of the divine. But it's really about the here and the now. The apocalyptic prophecy, the apocalyptic speech, which we date to, I mean, the main text is Daniel 165, more or less. But we have texts of apocalyptic speech going back into the 300s already in the first book of Enoch, the first chapters of that. But we'll put it in second century. Psalms of Solomon, a lot of those intertestamental texts are speech about the end of the world of sin, and it's coming soon in the future. So prophecy is about the present in its original sense. Apocalypse language is about prophesying the immediate future. We've said enough about that over this period of time. Wisdom speech. Here we get a late arriving, contemporaneous with apocalyptic speech, but very different from it, a kind of religious reflection and literature that comes under the Hellenistic period, so 300 and following, often in the diaspora, where people are exposed to Greek wisdom. Sophia in Greek means wisdom, like philosophia means love of wisdom, philosophy, right? And in and there's an influence of Egyptian wisdom, Greek wisdom, and traditional Jewish wisdom. The kinds of writings, the Book of Wisdom, or the Wisdom of Solomon, the Book of Proverbs, the Book of Sirach, and Ecclesiastes, etc., are basically about how to live well, morally, a good life, in community. It celebrates the virtues of the good housewife and mother. It celebrates the virtues of the honest man in the marketplace. It's made up of all different, many different forms, of which I put up three here. Proverbs that you can remember. So this is common wisdom, right? Aphorisms that you can easily remember and pull out and use in this instance. I remember my grandmother was speaking again of that Italian village that she came from. It's a village filled with proverbs. That's how they passed on information to each other. And there's now a book published with the proverbs of this little village in the north of Italy. Quite interesting. That's how village people communicate what you should and you shouldn't do. Sometimes the proverbs are wrong. Sometimes they're just common sense wisdom. Okay. Aphorisms, one-liners. But then parables. This is something unique to, as far as you can see, to Yeshua. It's picked up later by rabbinic Judaism. But usually those parables are to explain a text in the Mishnah or in the Talmud eventually. So in later rabbinic Judaism, parables are used as illustrations of the meaning of a certain text. But the way Yeshua uses them is different. So the common denominator is short fictional narratives. Let's see what we can do with that. As Scott points out, as everyone points out who's worked on parables, as Burton Mack points out, and Dodd, and so on, parables have been the subject of immense amount of work in the 20th century. Parables get used as allegories, especially in the Synoptic Gospels. An allegory is a story that you throw away once you get the point. Perhaps some of you have read Plato's Allegory of the Cave from the Republic. He's trying to teach you a somewhat complex philosophical idea about the hierarchy of forms of knowledge and what the highest form of knowledge would be. But that's going to put you to sleep. So he tells you a story. Imagine people who were born in a cave and never saw anything except the movies that are being shown on the wall. Now, he doesn't have movies, he's got puppets, their reflections being cast up there. We might as well say a movie. Your mother bore you and left you with a bag of popcorn in the movie theater. And that's all you've seen all of your life, the cave. And one day, when you're trying to slip out to go to the bathroom, you make a mistake and you go out the exit. And all of a sudden, you're in the real world. Your eyes, of course, are blinded. You've been in the dark all this time, seeing at best this gray world. But now you're outside, and there she is. Angelina Jolie, not just up on the screen, but in person. There's Brad. They're signing autographs. They're putting their hands in cement. I don't know. Now you've moved from an image to the really real. Not only the really real, but finally it dawns on you that the way you can see anything is due to the sunlight. Just as the way you saw in the cave was due to the light coming out of that projector up there. And that light above us that illuminates us is the source of everything. Runs back down into the cave to liberate the other people, and he sits down next to him. He's a little bit blinded in reverse because he went from dark into light, he's blinded. Now he went from light into dark, he's blinded. He sits down, and he starts to bother the people in the theater. Hey, come on, come out, right now. You know, I mean, the real stuff is out there. They say, will you please stop? It's the sex scene. Come on, let me watch this thing. No. He pulls on him. And Plato says, and if they could get their hands on him, what would they do? They would kill him. So it's an allegory of Socrates' life. He got out, saw the truth, came back and tried to communicate that, stumblingly, because he was blinded on his return, as it were, and they killed him. But it's more than that, it's an allegory of what human life and human knowing is about. Don't you see, we all live kind of in a realm of obscure knowledge, whereas true reality and truth is in another realm, a spiritual realm. Oh, now I get it. So you mean outside corresponds to the realm of pure meaning and ideas? Yeah. And inside corresponds to sort of like our everyday knowledge when we're caught up in our opinions and so on. Yeah. So now you can throw out the allegory. And now let's start talking about Plato's epistemology and ontology and anthropology. So the allegory is a ladder to get to or to illustrate an objective truth and you write it down in your notebooks. Okay, now I know what a Platonic epistemology is. Thanks very much for that allegory. That's really helpful. But I don't have to read it again. Right? So they're pedagogic, they're illustrational, they're objectifying, and you do see that. St. Augustine is famous for taking the parable of the Samaritan, for example, which is a shocking parable. Here's the way it would sound today. Once upon a time, a Jewish man was driving from his kibbutz in the West Bank to Hebron, and he was shot by a Palestinian terrorist and left for dead by the side of the road. An Orthodox Jew came by and said, oh, I can't touch him, that's impure, that's unclean. A Jewish social worker, the Jews are the good guys, right? Comes by and says, no, I'm too busy, I gotta keep going. And then, a Palestinian terrorist himself came down, someone who didn't know that the poor guy had been shot, sees him there, puts down his Kalashnikov, takes off his suicide bombs, puts them aside, picks the guy up, the Jewish guy, carries him all the way to a motel, rents a room, pays for the room, pays ahead a month, cleans the guy up, calls the best doctor he can, pays the doctor ahead of time, says, I'll be back if you need any more money, goes out, picks up his Kalashnikov, puts on his suicide bombs and leaves. You say, jeez, never heard a story like this. Something, I'm trying to invent the shock of an Iraqi terrorist picking up a Marine wounded or hurt and taking the Marine to a hospital and leaving him there. Boom, it's a one-time shocker. Augustine says, no. Don't you see that the pilgrim who's going from Jerusalem to Jericho is Adam? And he's descending from the heights of holiness, Jerusalem, down to the depths of Jericho, which is paganism and sin. And along the way he stumbles, he falls, he's upset, he's put upon, because that's the life of sin for you. Right? And then along comes the Old Testament, they don't help him. Then along comes the New Testament, they help. What have you got? You've got him, he doesn't understand what a Samaritan was. He doesn't know the street, he doesn't know that it's like an Iraqi terrorist. Right? So he has to find some meaning, and he makes up a story that covers the whole of salvation history. Or the parable of the sower, which is very difficult to get the original form of it. Some seed falls here, some seed falls there, some seed falls there, Mark says in chapter 4. And he goes inside and he says, now here's what I really meant by that. There's going to be some people who hear the word and they won't get it. Some people who will be sort of enthusiastic and then they'll drop. What's that? That's the Christian community talking about its current experience of evangelizing people. Some stick with the program, some don't. But it's an allegory. Once you know what that means, you don't need the parable itself. Okay. What is a parable? Crossan is very good on this in a book called On Parables, which is not an easy read, actually, even though he tries to make it popular. A parable is a metaphor. Now, he doesn't say this, I'm saying this. The etymology of metaphor is not just some sort of ornamental flourish that you put on your writing. It means forain, carry, meta, across. It picks you up where you are and carries you to another realm across a gap that you never knew about before and drops you there. You can go back if you want, but metaphor is a broad term that includes not just parables, that is a form of metaphor, but art of any sort. When you go to see a play, are you there to simply get some objective information? Okay, what's the theme here of this play? Oh, it's about love and death. Okay, I forget the play, I got the theme. No, you go there, get caught up in the characters, willing suspension of disbelief, you feel with them, weep with them, and all of a sudden you see the world that Eugene O'Neill lived in and suffered in Long Day's Journey into Night, right? And you come out exhausted if the play has had its good effect. It has transformed you. So metaphor is transform, takes you to a different place. But you can undergo that transformation only if you participate in the symbol, the metaphor. So I hate to go to museums with anybody, my beloved spouse, my best friend, my kids, because you know how we go to museums. Have you noticed the form? You know, you notice that's definitely early Van Gogh, as we pronounce it, instead of Van Gogh, as it's supposed to be pronounced. Yes, very soon. Let's go to the next one. You just keep moving on. Wait a minute. Somebody spent 4 or 5 years of her life painting this. Much art, as you know, is religious. It's been torn out of its religious context, stuck in a museum. You look at it and comment on whether it's early or late Renaissance, depending on the perspective, and on you go. Well, that's informational, illustrational. That's objectifying knowledge. You're supposed to sit there in front of that icon, feel those eyes looking at you, become part of that vision. You're not supposed to just look at it and objectify it. Art, if it's done well, philosophy, if done well, religion, if done well, instead of, you know, another sermon in the box and I'm out of here. No, it's supposed to be transformational. So that's what parables are supposed to be about, if done right. Not allegories that you throw away, but movements of you, invitations for you to participate, as I think Scott says beautifully, in a reimagined world. In that sense, they're like, are analogous to apocalyptic. The here and now world, banal, and a reimagined new world. But it's no longer apocalyptic crash and burn. The apocalypse, the revelation, is taking place in you, and it's a transformational apocalypse. Contrast a parable with a myth. And since we're talking about apocalypse is one of such myths. Myths are, first of all, about non-natural, supernatural divinities. And they try to transform you in a way that relates you to those divinities. Parables are about this worldly, you here and now, natural transformations. God is never mentioned in a parable. Angels, demons, never mentioned in the parables. Secondly, myths are about maintaining order and reconciling conflicts, foundational myths, etc. Myths, as I think Scott says very well, hide the fact that they're myths. You watch television, you're embodying, internalizing the American myth, let's say, right? Or you read a history book, at least the old history books that probably you and I read back in the, for me, in the 40s and the 50s. It's all about the great growth of this wonderful country. We're the best country. I mean, we do nothing but good for people from the get-go. I mean, you know, there are little aberrations like, you know, African-American slaves, you know, a few 100,000 Guatemalans killed in the 60s, 100,000 Salvadorans killed in the 80s, which would equal about 3.5 million Americans killed. Did you realize the proportion? Well, those are mistakes. Vietnam, another mistake. But really, so a myth is there to give you a reconciling story that holds things together, and it's there to not tell you it's a myth. It's supposed to be taken as the natural order of things. Whereas parables, at least in the mouth of Yeshua, and he's the real genius of parables until later on in the Jewish tradition, subvert the old order. And they invite you to be converted, so we'll play on the word turn. They overturn the old order in your mind, and they invite you to turn yourself around to a new order, a metanoia. Myths are things that you participate in passively. They're fed to you by your teachers, by your television, by your politicians, by your mother, you know, the myths of your family, etc. And you slowly internalize them the way you breathe the air without realizing that you're being infected or vivified, whatever you want to say, by them. But it's a passive acceptance, whereas parables throw this stuff in your face, subvert the common wisdom. They're part of the wisdom tradition, but they're extraordinary wisdom, not common wisdom. You know, a penny saved is a penny earned is common wisdom. These say, what do you make about the fact that that was an Iraqi terrorist who saved the life of the journalist or of the Marine? Jesus, I never thought of that. Or, as one of the colleagues was mentioning, what do you do with this parable? My father was a labor organizer in San Francisco for hod carriers and laborers union, my grandfather and the boilermakers union, so, you know, I don't know if you'd agree with me, I'm not making that point, but what would my father and my grandfather make of this parable? A guy, you know, he had to get this building put up and the boilers installed by nightfall. So he went down to the boilermakers union, he got some men, he said, I need as many of you as I can get. And sure, the boys showed up at about 7 o'clock, you know, they got suited up, they went in. He promised them $250 for a day's work. You know, that's damn good wages. And the Boilermaker's Local 6, we don't get that a lot. Or Hod Carrier's Local 36. Then you got the Hod Carriers and the bricklayers and the plasterers up there. He promises them $250 a day. So they're out there, boy, at the crack of dawn doing their work. Then some guys came into the hall, and the dispatcher said, hey, there's a job out there in the Potrero. Get your ass out there. They were not Boilermakers. And they want these guys get out there, but hell, it's noon. Right? So he says, get to work. We need more boilers downstairs. We need more bricks laid upstairs. And then some poor souls come out of the bar only at about 4 in the afternoon. They say, what's going on? They say, there's a job for you. Get over there. So these guys show up an hour beforehand. Now it's 6 o'clock. The whistle blows. They all go home. You arrived at what time?
6 o'clock.
2:50. You, however, arrived at?
At noon.
2:50. And you got here?
In the beginning.
You were at the beginning? 2:50. When did you get here?
8 in the morning.
Well, the hell with you. When did you get here? You got there 10 minutes ahead of 2:50. 10 minutes before. All of a sudden, you've upset the business agent, the secretary treasurer. What are we going to do at the dispatcher's office, you know? Get there an hour ahead of time, an hour before it's over, they give you 2:50. Then he says, go figure. By the way, I got to leave now. I have to, you know, go do some fishing or something. So all of a sudden, this shocking story of a sort of an abundance, but at the same time, isn't that stupid? Or as Crossan pointed out, this is not a parable, but it's also part of the contrarian wisdom. When you go to South Central LA, never carry a gun. Don't even carry a stick, or as Crossan said, just put a sign on yourself saying, ready to be mugged. You know, that's what it means to not carry a staff. You say, what? Doesn't make any sense. So they subvert your, not the old order, you are the old order, right? Your common wisdom is the old order. They invite you to participate in the new, but you can do it only if you make a decision yourself. And I'm not here to make that decision for you. I just told you a story. An intriguing story, interesting characters, interesting plot, very short, easy to remember because it's always got like threes in it, you know, so on and so forth. As contrasted with the passive acceptance of that. I think that's the last slide, and just as well because I think my computer's running out of juice. Let's talk now about, let's see, I'm going to turn that off, I think. There we go, more or less. Let's talk about, in the half hour that we've got less, two parables. The parable of the woman and the yeast, or leaven, and the parable of the mustard seed. They share something in common that's background matrix knowledge that most of us aren't familiar with and we were filled in. And it has to do with purity codes, or holiness codes. The book of Leviticus is the third book of the Pentateuch, or Torah, right? The first five books of the Bible. The third book of the Bible is the locus of purity codes. And not, it's not the only place, but the most famous place. And that underlies both the mustard seed and the leaven story. So I'm going to presume that you've been able to look. I picked these two because of the first two chapters, and I invite you to read all of the rest, especially the conclusion part of Scott's book, which is really quite good. And let's look now at what the background of this is. Not only Judaism, but many religions that go back into antiquity, into archaic antiquity, have a category that divides everything. Sacred, not sacred, or sacred and profane, or holy and profane. Two categories. That's a basic given, not just as I say in Judaism, but in every major religion back there. And the point of the holy and the sacred, this separation, is to preserve the power of the divine, which is awesome. And to recognize, I mean, what underlies both sides of that division is a kind of a magical thinking that says reality isn't just sort of like what's out there. Reality is charged with power. It's got good power or it's got taboo power, as we say from the Polynesian word that Captain Cook actually brought back in 1768, taboo, with a U, we spell it with a double O. It means don't go near things that have bad karma, bad medicine about them. Right? So there's a magical sense that power is coming in at you all the time. Good power and bad power. If this one gets you, this charged power of certain things, how they get that power is almost an empirical question. You can be really in deep trouble. Or if you want to be in the party of the divine, you have to have left the realm of the profane and moved into the realm of the holy. The word profane doesn't mean bad language. Fanum in Latin, F-A-N-U-M, anybody? It means a temple. It's in one of the many words for temple. Pro means in front of, outside of, not within the temple. So it's that which is outside the realm of the sacred, as contrasted with that which is in the realm of the sacred. So the danger is that over here, things will be unclean. Unclean doesn't refer to dirt on your hands, doesn't refer to dirty thoughts in your mind. It's just one of the many words for distinguishing between the holy, that which is set aside for the gods, and that is filled with the power of a good charge power that you can use, and that which is not. So you never want to mix these. Again, that text in Leviticus 19:19 is, God is so holy, so other, you'd never want to mix up the wrong things with him. That comes down to cultic and other kinds of non-mix. So holiness happens at three levels. The first level is, we'll call it the theological or numinous level, and refers to God. Numinous just means divine. God is so other that you don't want to mix anything with him, right? Except that which is his. That's the primary concept. We're trying to preserve the autonomy and distinction, the autonomy of God and the radical distinction, the holy otherness. So what is holiness there? It means power. Unapproachable, majestic power. So when you go into that realm, maybe it's in your temple once a year that you go into the Holy of Holies, or wherever it is, you never want to take anything in there that would mix the unholy with the holy. So the whole purpose of holiness codes is to preserve the notion of the one, for Judaism, monotheism. The second level of holiness codes is ritual holiness, or ritual cleanliness or uncleanliness. Now, when we say ritual, it means that you didn't do anything wrong. You just happen to have touched like poison oak or a dead corpse or something like that. You became contaminated with the non-divine. How it got that way is another question, why we call some things unclean and unholy. You got contaminated with it, so we've got to purify you. No, it's not your problem. We'll just put some calamine lotion on that poison oak, or we'll give you a ritual bath to get you cleansed. So that's ritual uncleanliness. And we clean you up by withdrawing you from the profane through a sacralizing rite or a purifying rite. The third one is moral uncleanness, and that you are responsible for. So that if you offend God's law, or you do something horrible to your neighbor, or if you lead an unchaste life, etc., that's the third type, and you're responsible for that. Now, purity, clean, impure, unclean is pre-Mosaic. It goes way back before the Mosaic Code, and it's not just specifically Jewish. You know, we find it in Islam, we find it in all sorts of religions. What are the things that could be charged with bad power? It all depends on who you are and where you're from. People can have bad power. They can have bad karma that can infect you. So if I'm Jewish, goyim, Gentiles, bad karma. In fact, in late Judaism, in late, late Second Temple Judaism, some Jews avoided any contact with the goyim, any contact with a male who's uncircumcised. You don't want to be at his house, you don't want to be invited to him, you don't want to, as John says, enter into the courtyard of Pontius Pilate on the day before Passover and Sabbath together. They fall together this year. You go in there, you're unclean, oh my God, off to the baths, got to clean up. And, you know, the wife's already getting the Passover meal ready. There's going to be no time. So people can be unclean. Things can be unclean. Corpses are unclean. That is to say, you don't ever want to bring a corpse into God's presence, right? Because it's dead and it's no longer vivified. Yeah? War is unclean, believe it or not. You have to engage in it sometimes, but you definitely want to do purification rituals about that. Activities can be unclean. Copulation is unclean, not because it's messy or dirty or but just simply, I mean, that's for us and this is for God. So after copulation, clean yourself up in a purification ritual. Right? Or the menses of a woman are unclean, or childbirth is unclean. There's nothing wrong with these things. They're just not what you want to trot into God. All the unclean in some way hinders your rapport with the divine. We'll get to leaven in a second. Huh? Let's see if I want to do... there's all sorts of examples, you know. And actually, holy things can make you unclean in a certain way. You can't, let's see how to put this. A priest can't wear his holy robes outside the temple. He has to change into street clothes in the Jewish tradition, right? If you are unclean, you touched a corpse, or animals are unclean, birds of prey are unclean, reptiles are unclean, four kinds of locusts are clean. You can eat them. John the Baptist was okay. Shellfish are unclean because the only good fish are the ones that have both fins and scales. Shellfish don't. They're out. Right, and so on. The food, the dietary laws of Israel, for example. So if you happen to have done an unclean thing, by accident perhaps, you have to be purified. That doesn't mean that you become holy. It just means you become you've overcome your uncleanness and now could go over here and enter into the Holy of Holies and there be sanctified and dedicated to the divine. The danger with any purity codes, be they Christian, Catholic, Muslim, anything, is of course formalism, that they will just be done for their own sake without one realizing that the real purpose of it is respect for the divine, preserving the otherness of the divine, and not bringing into the divine messy sort of stuff. The interesting thing is, I'll read you the text if you don't have your good book with you, but St. Peter has a vision in Acts of the Apostles. First of all, moving from Tanakh into Christianity, what it seems is, I'm leaping ahead, I'm not proving this empirically, right? Yeshua seems to be in the tradition of wisdom, not Torah. The wisdom tradition of the Hellenic period gave up on the rituals of cleanliness, uncleanliness. They just simply said, be a good moral person. So have some shellfish. That doesn't really contaminate you, as long as your morals are in the right place. The prophets have been saying this. Don't give me all your sacrifices and all your ritual purity. Give me justice, says God. That's what I want. So already there's a tradition in the prophets, and especially in the wisdom literature, of doing away with the formalities of uncleanness as long as your heart is in the right place. And that's what Yeshua does. He comes in as a Jew, speaking within Judaism, but within the wisdom tradition of Judaism. He's not condemning Judaism for being formalistic. He says, here's a way that's a more humane way. Contributions of Yeshua to Judaism, not against Judaism. By the time you get to Paul and to Peter even, still Jews, you get a vision like this. Let me see if I can find it. This is in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 10, and it's a real good text for illustrating how within Judaism things are changing. So this is verse 9 of chapter 10. So if you go to Acts of the Apostles, it's right after John's Gospel, or I'll just read it to you. You don't have to find it. A Gentile named Cornelius seems to have had a vision that he should get in touch with this Jewish man, Peter. But wait a minute, Peter's not going to touch a Gentile. He's goy. He's uncircumcised. So Peter is in the same town, Caesarea Maritima, and he goes up on top of his house one day and has a vision. It occurs.